Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why Axon and Scottsdale officials appear to be at an impasse over the company's development plan.
And a formerly undocumented immigrant on finding the courage to tell her story.
But first, Arizona House Republicans have unveiled their budget proposal for the fiscal year that starts on July 1st. The more than $17 billion plan includes a pay raise for corrections officers and money for road and other infrastructure projects. What it doesn't include, though, is buy-in from the state Senate and Governor Katie Hobbs, who are negotiating on their own separate plan. The House Appropriations Committee is scheduled to start going through the budget proposal in a little more than an hour from now. Earlier this morning, Representative Matt Grass, the panel's vice chair, came by the studio to talk about it. And we started with what some highlights of the proposal are for him.
Absolutely. Yesterday, House Republicans introduced a budget for the upcoming fiscal year. It's balanced. It prioritizes law and order. So we invest in public safety, critical infrastructure. We protect the most vulnerable, and we help working Arizona families. So, and we do it all without raising taxes. And I think that's a really important feature of this budget. So in total, I think it's a strong start, and it also incorporates executive and Senate priorities.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that because, as has been reported, the Senate and the governor's office have been working on their own plan separate from this. Why do you have optimism that you can bring them on board to this plan as opposed to the one that they're negotiating?
I don't necessarily think they're going to come on board to our plan, just as we're not going to come on to their plan. It's going to be a compromise, a collaboration. We've reached out to the Senate and to the governor's office multiple times, and they have decided to go it alone. But ultimately, this bill is going to require cooperation from the House and from Republicans. So we kept an eye on that, and that's why we included a lot of the priorities of the Senate and the governor in the budget to begin with, because we know we're headed that way.
What are some of those similarities? Like, what did you take from what you know of the Senate and governor's office proposal, which is not final, we should say, to incorporate into yours?
So the Senate members have a number of different key asks that we are aware of, that they've shared with us. And it ranges from infrastructure to child welfare to education. And same with the governor's priorities. She laid them out in her executive budget back in January. So we had a blueprint on what we could draw from. And a lot of these things are critical services, funding the Department of Corrections, for instance, or the Department of Child Safety, making sure that those resources are there so that these populations are not threatened by, the potential bankruptcy. We've also fully funded our Medicaid programs and the developmentally disabled programs, fully funded all of them based on the new caseload estimates that the executive has shared with us. So I believe it's a responsible package, and I think it should get a lot of attention.
Given your experience with budgets, you, of course, were a big part of Governor Ducey's budget office. What do you make of the fact that here we are on June 12th and the House and Senate, both led by Republicans, are not on the same page on the budget?
You know, every budget is different. And in my experience as budget director, we had issues when the House and the Senate weren't on the same page. And the job of the executive was to try to bring both chambers back together. That really hasn't happened with this governor. They've been MIA in terms of their interaction with the House Republicans. But be it as it may, I mean, this budget will get done. And I think you're seeing progress both on the House side. We're moving forward and going to be voting on it this week. The Senate is planning to introduce their budget plan on Friday. And they'll go to appropriations on Monday. So I think you'll see a meeting of the minds early next week.
One of the big differences, it seems, between the Senate budget and the House budget is this idea of sort of divvying up pots of money, that the Senate gets a certain amount, the House gets a certain amount, the governor gets a certain amount. Why to you, and you have been on record saying that you do not like that idea, what to you about that makes it not a good idea?
You have to balance statewide priorities with member asks. There are big projects, and we're talking about perhaps the 347, one of the five most deadly highways.
State Route 347.
State Route 347 between I-10 and the city of Maricopa, or an expansion in the West Valley of Interstate 10 to build out the infrastructure there based on the growth due in large part to TSMC and others. Basic critical services for the Department of Child Safety and Corrections. All of these things are of statewide concern, and they require all of us, the House, the Senate, and the governor, to invest in them. But divvying up the monies and forgetting about basic government services is short-sighted, and it has resulted in shortfalls and lots of supplementals this year because of that process. So our approach is, let's fund some of these big statewide initiatives, and we can also take care of member needs as they arise in terms of the whole package. So a hybrid model is what the House proposes.
Do you see the Senate version in some way as a modified version of what you all did a couple of years ago called the Oprah budget, and not in a complimentary way, which led the state into not great financial situations?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you took a $4 billion surplus that Governor Ducey left, Governor Hobbs, and turned it into a $2 billion deficit in 1 year. And it relied on inflating revenues. It spent way too much. And we had to cut the next year. And some of those cuts, I think, were detrimental to population served. That's why I voted against the budget.
So would it be your expectation that at the end of the day, the version, because there has to be a budget that passes, the version that ultimately the House and Senate approve and the governor signs will be some kind of combination between what the Senate and governor are negotiating and what you are looking to approve?
Exactly. And that is the reality of shared government, where you have Republicans controlling the legislature and the Democrats controlling the governor's office. There will be a compromise. It will likely be a hybrid model. And we just need to get it done because time is ticking.
How are you trying to account for all the uncertainty in terms of revenue, be it from tax collections in the state or what the state may or may not be getting from the federal government?
And that is certainly a big topic of discussion, hard to predict what the Congress will do. But I think that the most prudent course of action is ensuring we're not inflating our revenues beyond reasonable expectations, and also keeping large cash balances. That budget 2 years ago had an ending cash balance of just $11 million out of an $18 billion budget. So the budget plan that we put forward yesterday leaves an ending balance of $429 million. That's cash that we're going to need, certainly to accommodate if revenues don't come in, even on forecast of what's what we have in our budget. But there are also other needs. For instance, there are cost-sharing provisions in the federal tax bills that the state would need to pick up, or the tax reforms themselves. Should we conform with the no tax on tips or additional benefits for seniors? If we conform with those, that costs money. And so we need to be prepared going into the next legislative session to make those decisions in a financially responsible way.
All right. That is State Representative Matt Grass, Vice Chair of the House Appropriations Committee. Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thanks.
Cristina Jimenez is no stranger to the raging debate over immigration reform. Jimenez arrived in the United States at the age of 13 when her family fled Ecuador. She navigated all of middle school, high school, college, and early adulthood as an undocumented immigrant. But Jimenez didn't just tiptoe through gaps in the system. From an early age, she was an outspoken advocate for fellow undocumented people, working as an organizer on behalf of DACA. Among other things, she co-founded the immigrant youth advocacy group United We Dream, and she received a MacArthur Fellowship in 2017. Earlier this year, Jimenez published a memoir called Dreaming of Home, which tells the story of how she found her voice as an activist. I spoke to her recently, and she told me that, among other things, she wanted to convey the day-to-day emotional reality of living life in the shadows.
There's just so much fear for things that people do on a day-to-day basis, like going to the bank, like going to seek health care, like going to a school, like going to a supermarket. Yeah. You know, even the most small of day-to-day activity carries so much risk. And I realized that even though those people on the other side of the counter, many of them are probably your listeners, teachers, people in the healthcare field, you may not know, but you have so much power.
Yeah.
You have so much power to make or break the life and the dreams of people on the other side of the counter, like me.
One of the other things it underscores is how important certain individuals who you come across in your life become to your story. And one of those people is somebody who in the book you call Mrs. B.
Who I still, by the way, keep in touch with,
you know,
more than 15 years later. I meet Miss B in my high school in Queens, New York City, one of the most diverse counties in the country. In my high school, there are over 70 languages that were spoken. And she is my ESL teacher and also the advisor of the Key Club, which, you know, promotes community service. She becomes the first educator that I feel safe sharing that I'm undocumented. So when my college advisor tells me you can't go to college because you are undocumented and doesn't try to help me, and I am just shattered and heartbroken and I'm crying, thinking I won't be able to make it to college, I went to speak to Ms. B. And at the time, you know, many educators did not know how to help students like me. Mm-hmm. And she was sincere about that. She told me, you know, I don't know how to help, but I will figure out a way and get back to you. Mm-hmm. And she did. Mm-hmm. And with her help, I was able to apply to the City University of New York.
Right.
And go to college. And so like Ms. V, I think about, you know, educators, people in this moment that are engaging with immigrant families who have a choice to support these communities by providing information and help or to close the door on them.
Right. Right. And there's also this sense in the way that you describe Ms. B that she is aware of the stakes of the fact that you have divulged this information to her, that it makes you so vulnerable.
Ms. B, I remember, you know, not even flinching when I said that. You know, because I'm sharing this and the thing that I'm thinking about is what's going to happen next. Is she going to reject me? Am I going to have to explain that my family and I are not criminals? And instead, what I get was a smile and a reminder that our conversation will remain confidential.
Hmm. Understandably, this book was not easy for you to write. And I was very intrigued by a brief story in the acknowledgments about a pivotal conversation that you had with the writer Sandra Cisneros that changed your relationship to the story.
Yes. You know, through the process of writing, I think I let my mind and my head to be more dominant in how I was engaging with this work. Mm-hmm. And so when I started writing, I started actually, you know, from a really angry place.
Mm.
And I was writing more from a place of being a strategist. Sandra Cisneros said, you know, Christina, you sound very uncomfortable. Like you're wearing this suit that it's very tight. Mm-hmm. So what don't you get in your pajamas and you write from that place? And what she was, you know, what she called me to do is to listen to my heart and to tap in that place of vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And that's how I found my voice. And I did the exercise as a good student of my friend and mentor.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And I said, you know, I need to be in my pajamas and I need to be in bed.
Could you give me an example, Christina, of something that found its way into a draft of the book after she told you that, like when you wrote the pajama draft that hadn't been there before?
My love story. So there is a chapter in the book. The chapter title is Walter, mm-hmm. who is my husband. And I met him as a fellow undocumented student in New York City. And he's the first undocumented student that I meet.
Yeah.
And our friendship evolves into, falling in love with each other. And that story was not in my first draft. Mm-hmm. But I realized how it was such a big, important moment of my life when I contended with love as an undocumented person and having to worry about so many considerations just when you're even considering who to date. Yeah. Imagine that.
Thank you for sharing that, Christina. I'm so appreciative that you brought up that specific example, because I literally have it on my list here to ask you about. That for me is the most powerful part of the book, is when you talk about the realization that you and Walter are falling in love. Because as a reader, you know, the story's going along and I'm like, oh, these guys are definitely getting together. Like, it's happening. Like, from a narrative standpoint, you do such a lovely job of, it's such a meeting of the minds and a meeting of the hearts in terms of the things you care about. And then you have this really moving passage where you talk about how it's different for the two of us to consider the idea of having a life together, because it's not necessarily up to us that would happen.
Yes, it was deciding, are we willing to choose each other even though one of us could be deported?
Yeah.
At any time. And in unfortunate and fortunate ways, our journey ended up having to face deportation. Walter ends up being targeted for deportation as he was going on a train to a meeting that we were convening of immigrant youth leaders in Chicago. And Border Patrol agents get in the train at like 2 or 3 a.m. in the morning, put a flashlight in front of his face and asked him if he was a citizen. And when he says no, he's arrested and then taken to a jail in upstate New York and immediately put on deportation proceedings. And it is that situation, the fact that I could lose Walter forever, that sparks in us the clarity. We chose to give our love a chance because we did not want the injustice of our immigration system to take away our right to love each other.
Well, Christina Jimenez is the author of Dreaming of Home, How We Turn Fear into Pride, Power, and Real Change. The book is out now. Christina, thank you for this conversation.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a veteran journalist looks back on 50 years of telling tribal stories through community reporting.
But first, the long-running drama between the city of Scottsdale and Axon, the major manufacturer of law enforcement equipment, has taken yet another turn. To recap, for months now, Axon, which was originally founded in a garage in Tucson, has been trying to build a major world headquarters campus in Scottsdale, where the company has been based for many years. But the proposed expansion has faced waves of controversy. Scottsdale residents tried unsuccessfully to get a referendum on the project put on the ballot for 2026. The state legislature recently passed a bill allowing Axon to proceed. Axon had been working with the city council to reach a compromise on the scope of its plans, but those negotiations broke down earlier this week, with Axon's president declaring that their talks with the council had dissolved into, quote, toxicity. Axios's Jeremy Duda has been following all of this, and he joins us now. Jeremy, good morning.
Good morning.
So, Jeremy, tell us, what was the nature of these conversations that broke down between Axon and the city council? What exactly was being discussed?
Well, you had a number of folks on the city council, I think probably the majority of the city council, who were hoping to reach some sort of accord with Axon where they would lower the number of housing units in this headquarters building they're going to be building at Hayden and Lupa 101. It's supposed to be about 1,900 apartment units and condos. There's also supposed to be some other stuff, a small hotel, restaurants, et cetera, other stuff on the site. But the apartments are really what have got a lot of folks bothered out there. And that's what's generated all the opposition we've seen, you know, over the past, you know, 7-8 months or longer than that, but really ramping up since about December.
And do we know where things stood with the conversation in terms of the number of units at the time the talks broke down? Because, as you mentioned, initially the number was 1,900. We've seen it as low as 850. Where had they sort of netted out in these talks?
From my understanding is that Axon had gone down to around 1,700. But I think, you know, a lot of folks at the city council, they were hoping to get a lot lower than that. But you know, they don't have a heck of a lot of leverage to make that happen at this point.
And just to be clear, why is Axon saying that they need this housing to be built?
I mean, I believe that the point of this is to kind of make the whole project viable. I mean, this is a headquarters building. This is a very large project that would house, you know, not just the headquarters for this major company, but adds the other things they want to, I think, to make that a more profitable operation.
I see. So this breakdown in talks where Axon has basically stepped away from the negotiations, it seems, what does that mean in a practical sense? Do they just start construction? Are there any remaining obstacles?
Oh, it means they're going, I mean, they say they, what they tell me is they're going to move ahead with the project as planned. As I mentioned, there's not, you know, they didn't have a lot of incentive to negotiate, and the Scottsdale City Council didn't have a lot of leverage. As you may recall, the legislature and Governor Katie Hobbs passed a law recently that basically blocks, for all intents and purposes, a referendum election that's supposed to be on the ballot next November to where people could vote on whether to reverse the zoning change that the city council made last year that would allow this to happen. That is what kind of triggered this latest round of negotiations at, Axon no longer really needs anything from Scottsdale. They don't need any kind of agreements for this building to move forward as they'd planned it. And so that's kind of where things stand now. They plan to move ahead. Now, there could be other obstacles. There's, talk of the city. The city has retained a lawyer, I believe, to potentially sue over this law that blocks the referendum election. So right. That'll go to court. There's talk of a possible referendum campaign to try to put that law on the ballot, which I think is far less likely to happen. That's a very high hurdle in terms of the number of signatures you have to collect in a very short amount of time. And plus, outside of Scottsdale, maybe even just out of that part of Scottsdale, I'm not sure how many voters actually care about this and how much that would mean to folks outside of that particular area.
It starts to get confusing somewhat quickly, because if I'm tracking this correctly, that would be a referendum on a law about referenda. Is that right?
Yes, and a law that would really only affects a small handful of cities. It was very narrowly tailored, doesn't only affect Scottsdale, it affects a few other cities as well. But for all intents and purposes, it was passed specifically to take in this Scottsdale election and stop that from happening.
Gotcha. And what do we know from, obviously, you know, we've been talking about what Axon is saying about this. What has the city of Scottsdale said about this so-called toxicity?
It depends. I'm not sure what the, there's different folks here, because they've been dealing with what you have. The Scottsdale is, I think, it's hard to argue, it's not a toxic environment for reasons that have nothing to do with Axon. You've had a lot of discord there since the new city council and new mayor took over. You have a kind of majority faction of four people on the council that has been at odds mostly with Mayor Borowski, the new mayor, since they all took office, even though they're all Republicans. Josh Isner, the president of Axon, said there were three members of the council who have been very obstructionist, although he made a point of kind of praising both Mayor Borowski and one of the council members, who's a member of that four-person faction, Adam Quasman, said the two of them, they've had good negotiations with them, had good things to say about them, but the other three people in that majority faction, at least according from the Axon president's view, have been the problem.
All right. Well, we'll have to leave it there for now. That is Axios's Jeremy Duda bringing us up to speed. Jeremy, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Congress passed the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act in 1990. It aims to facilitate the protection and return of Native American items, including funerary objects, human remains, and sacred objects. And over the 30-plus years since it was enacted, the law has led to the repatriation of a number of items, but challenges remain. Shandine Mayo has written about this. She's a grad student at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication at ASU. Her piece appeared in Arizona Highways magazine. I spoke with her earlier and asked how the law has worked over the years.
Yeah, so when I was tasked with writing this topic, I actually had to learn about it myself. It was the first time that I heard about this law, and all the interviewees were, even though they all had different backgrounds and approaches to this law, it was very important to them, not only culturally, but also in their profession as well. And one thing that I didn't learn is that I believe it's interpreted in different ways, especially when it comes to an Indigenous person who it is their relatives, and versus a person who might be interpreting the law on like a Wednesday afternoon as part of their job.
Well, so has that led to different enforcement or following of the law?
I believe so. So I think when I was interviewing and researching this story, from what I understood, the people on the ground were like obviously a little bit more hands-on because they were dealing with the artifacts and their relatives. And so I think that they were a little bit more aware of the law and the real impacts of this, maybe whereas someone who is more aware of the regulations, just like following the regulations and are, you know, motivated by different things. Like when I was hearing the museum employees, it was their duty and motivation to actually reduce the amount of artifacts that were in their museum. And so, yeah, I believe everyone interpreted it differently and is motivated to do good things in different ways.
How have those different ways of looking at this law impacted the way that the work that it is aiming to have carried out be carried out?
Well, I think there are so many moving parts after reading about this. You have the museum side, which is working as fast as they can with their limited resources. And then you also have like the, after that, it goes to the actual return of the ancestors. And even that itself, when I was interviewing the source who was doing the work on the ground, was saying that they're a one person operation. And it is also like a very much a cultural interaction when they do return the ancestors. So they have to do extra work to make sure that they protect themselves and their family and loved ones. And then you also have like, you know, legislative initiatives to try to give funding to speed up the process. But definitely it's like fast and slow, and maybe it stops there. But at the end of the day, I think all the interviewees were just really dedicated to returning their people.
What is the significance of this law and what it represents to Indigenous communities?
The significance is the return of familiar items and our relatives. I think when I was first writing this, I was like, oh my gosh, how do I write this? It's like, it's about a law. It's about something that has happened a while ago. And how do I write this to make it relatable? I think everyone has experienced a loss of something. And I think that's one way that I tried to communicate how Native people have felt for generations. One of the sources who is working on the return in his Indigenous community, what he said was really profound. And one of his prayers that he gives is, you know, thank you, and I hope you return to us, and so that way we can continue our ways of living. And I think that's what it means.
It sounds like there are other challenges associated with carrying out this law, even, you know, among well-meaning museum employees, just in terms of the challenges of maybe determining where a particular artifact should go.
Yeah. So one of the interviewees was talking about this, and they were saying that due to the lack of documentation, a lot of the artifacts, when they're being distributed, is that people don't know where they go or where it belongs because of the continuous migration and, you know, colonization has really changed the landscape back then and even now. And so what the interviewee continued to say and share that, like, even tribes themselves may have conflicting views on where the item may go. And so just those distinctions and, you know, fluid boundaries and meanings based off the items also further create confusion, which is another obstacle.
Sean Dean Mayo is a grad student at the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication at ASU.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. And today we continue our week-long series of conversations about modern masculinity with a look at a specific word, machismo. It's been used a lot recently, but our next guest says there are two distinct origins of the word. Nicole Guidotti Hernandez is a professor of English at Northeastern University and says one of those origins comes from the 1930s when a man named Oscar Lewis did several ethnographies in small rural villages in Mexico and Puerto Rico.
Lewis basically tried to identify key characteristics of what kept Mexican and Puerto Rican families impoverished, both materially, morally, and culturally. And so the conclusion was that men of these persuasions are demasculinized by socioeconomic conditions, and that the way that they prove their pluck and mettle as men is by exerting the dominance of patriarchy within the home.
Guidotti Hernandez says that was part of the social science conversation through roughly the 1950s. She says the second origin for machismo is in a more Latin American context, in particular in Mexico in the 1920s and 30s.
This term really emerges in the post-revolutionary context of Mexico with working class masculinity and the figure of the pelado, which is essentially a working class guy of the street. And it is a way for elites to distinguish the different characteristics between uneducated and educated populations.
Guidotti Hernandez says the two ideas ultimately got joined together and traveled up and down the Americas. And when we spoke earlier, she pointed out that she's not a fan of the word.
I am really not a fan of the word machismo because I think it basically simplifies an idea of masculinities that are context and historical specific with historical specificity, but that instead create a pathology that sort of defines Latinx masculinities throughout the hemisphere, right? Which is, if you're excessively violent, excessively patriarchal, you know, a misogynist, but somehow that gets attached to a racialized body, I think is the idea that travels up and down the hemisphere.
Do you find that this word is applied to different people differently?
Absolutely, 100%. When we're talking about Latinx men, especially Afro-Latinx men, it's dismissive, right? It's both racial, cultural, and sociological, which is to say, like, oh, that's just machismo. That's just how this population is inherently. They don't respect women. They don't, you know, they value the family, but only in the context of their privileges, the capacity to move around in the world where women and daughters are policed and kept at home, which doesn't mean that that's not true. It just means that it's a typology that rests on a stereotype. But if we look at other ways that machismo becomes a different kind of political critique, when we talk about something like feminicidio or the systematic murdering of women and girls and trans women included, my feminist colleagues here in Mexico, which I happen to be here right now, would say que es machista, right? Which is a way to name misogyny, violence, gender normativity, and essentially a disregard for women and girls, trans women included, as subjects of their own making, and instead resorting to femicide as a way to control those who act outside of the boundaries of womanhood. So I would say that whenever you hear those words crop up, you want to ask yourself the question, what does this person mean in the context, versus, oh, that's just the way that X is, let's move on.
What about when white people, white men, are described as acting with machismo or displaying the tendencies of machismo? Like, what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, there's one primary example in the media that I feel like we can't hide from right now, and that would be the president. And for me, when people call him macho, or they say that he's participating in, you know, the tropes and tried ideas of being masculine, it's pretty farcical from a historical standpoint, because I think that the word is being used to cover up white frailty, to apologize without apologizing for white rage, for making misogyny by white men against women of color, queers, women, you know, anyone not a white straight man, less than. So for me, when I see people talking about Trump as macho, there's a few things going on there. It's an expression of white racism. It's an expression of white masculinity as the dominant masculinity. It is a linchpin in justifying misogyny, and it is a way of exhibiting power in the diplomatic sphere as well as in the domestic sphere. And when I mean the domestic sphere, I don't just mean internal national politics. I mean within people's homes and hearts and minds.
Well, do you think there's maybe a certain irony in terms of when a white man is referred to in the context of machismo? It's often done sort of respectfully or glowingly, like it's a compliment. Whereas, you know, men of color are often, when that word is used to describe them, it's often not in such positive terms.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that 100%. And even butch, Latinx, and, you know, Black, Afro-Latinx, queer folks, when somebody says, oh, they're trying to be very macho, it's about a false masculinity, a false Mexican masculine prowess. It's a slur. But when it's attached to white men, it does indeed become a compliment. But I would argue that the compliment is about covering up deficiencies more so than it is about, and it's about white anxiety. Right? Because somehow if individuals are not macho, if they're not exhibiting prowess in the public sphere, then what are they doing?
What do you think the discourse around this word and sort of what it means and its concept says about how we see masculinity across different cultures?
So I am always a proponent of gender as a spectrum. And this idea that there is no one way to be masculine or feminine or non-binary or trans or intersex. The idea for me is that it's flexible, it's situational. So all of these ideas suggest to us that there is a real, I would say, dialogue between what we perform as masculinity in public, what one's my biology may have been, could have been, is, and how we want to be seen in the world.
With all the talk over the last number of months about masculinity and, you know, what it means and how it's evolved and sort of its role in society right now. Do you see any of that changing or evolving the meaning of the word machismo or the concept of machismo going forward?
Well, as an educator and intellectual, I would say that Gen Z and Gen Alpha are the real barometer of what is and what is to come. And so the place where I see the most change, especially in the classroom, has to do with young people coming to the table with a critical idea that gender and sexuality are not fixed.
Nicole Guidotti Hernandez is a professor of English at Northeastern University. Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Mark Trahant is the recipient of this year's I.F. Stone Medal, an annual award celebrating, quote, integrity, courage, and indefatigability in journalism. Trahant's career spans five decades. In addition to his work as a reporter at the Arizona Republic, he's reported for Frontline, been an editor at the Seattle Post-Intelligencer and the Salt Lake Tribune, and a Pulitzer finalist. He's a member of the Shoshone-Bannock tribe, and Trahant also spent many years as the editor and publisher of the Navajo Times and ICT, previously known as Indian Country Today, where he served as editor until January of this year. Trahant stopped by the studio last week to reflect on 50 years of life as a print journalist, but he told me he actually got his start in radio, where he found himself reading short, 150-word summaries of major news stories.
And it's in that context that I really started looking for a deeper story, and one that wasn't coming across in, what, 150-word story.
Yeah.
I have a friend who's a historian, and she said one of the ways you know whether or not someone's a historian is they narrow their eyes and say that's complicated. And if they don't say that, they don't have the lingo down and therefore can't be a historian. I think that's the same for journalism. You have to look at a story, take the headlines, and then say, but it's more complicated than that, and here's why.
Yeah. Well, as an example of that, I was reading a piece that you wrote that was sort of a retrospective on your 50 years of work. And you were talking about a number of different stories that you did over the years where there were very significant complications that it seemed like it was important to you to kind of on your way out the door, so to speak, remind people about. One of those was the way that gaming gets covered now. Can you talk a little bit about the nuance you feel is important to keep in mind there?
Sure. And this gets into a word that many journalists don't use, and that's epistemology.
Let's
do it. How do we know what we know? And one of the things that we do in journalism is to look at the last story written. And when you do that, you look for that one paragraph that explains what's going on. And with Indian gaming, that has just become something that we look out and see the casinos. We look at the impact on the economy. But we don't think about where it came from. And that's one where it's actually told almost completely backwards. Tribes fought all the way to the Supreme Court for the right to have casino games without state regulation. And then Congress jumped in with the Indian Gambling Regulatory Act. And when they did that, the story became, oh, Congress gave tribes the right to do gambling, when it's exactly backwards. And we couldn't have imagined in 1970s how significant it was to the economy, how many people employs. And most of the employment is non-Indians.
The other thing that you wrote in this particular section of this retrospective is, I'll just read the quote. There is a misperception about journalists, and here I think you're talking about indigenous journalists in particular, being, quote, advocates.
Right.
Yet none of our counterparts has to explain why a city exists or a state, yet tribal editors must defend tribal government to other journalists, readers, and critics. This is not advocacy journalism, at least not to me. It's explanation. Can you talk a little bit more about that tension?
Sure. And I think this goes to education. When we teach what government is, we start with the federal government, and we talk about states, and we talk about cities and counties. And yet tribes are constitutional governments. They've been in the Constitution and have a history that's, in some cases, 10,000 years old. So if you were to start that process in schools and say, here's where tribal governments fit in, by the time you're writing a news story about it wouldn't be so contentious. It would just be a matter of fact. I mean, we still are in a situation, particularly in broadcast and particularly television, where there's just so little Native American participation. And so people aren't hearing voices that would help explain the country's history or some of the complexities, particularly in the West.
Related to this idea of making sure that, you know, certain stories are told, there is also a really great story about you having the chance to ask Walter Mondale a question. And you, I guess at the time, your customary reporting outfit was like a pair of jeans, and you thought you needed to dress up, so you went out and you bought this coat from JCPenney. and then you were sweating profusely, waiting to get...
It was very warm that day.
Yeah. I actually wanted to ask you a little bit about this question of wardrobe, because you talk in that story about wearing jeans, wearing boots. I imagine that must have helped make you seem more approachable when you're out trying to talk to people. I've also seen pictures of you in this very dapper, like, fedora. how much do you feel thinking about the way that you're dressed, the way that you physically engage with a source matters?
If you're going to rural Arizona and you're wearing an REI jacket, they're going to talk to you very differently than if you're wearing a Carhartt jacket.
Right.
I think the best dress is a mirror, and you want your source to be the one that they're thinking about, not you. I think really the important thing is to think about how you can be at home with people.
Yeah.
And let them know that, one, you're engaged, but two, you really like listening to them. Yeah. And you want to hear their story. When they had the Navajo riots, and which was kind of the January 6th of Navajo Nation, and I was in the Republic newsroom. Phone rang. They told me what was going on, and I grabbed a photographer. We flew to Gallup, and so we were up there in maybe, I don't know, an hour and a half after it started. I was dressed in a newsroom style, so I had a suit and jacket on. We got surrounded, and people had these large bats, baseball bat-like, but they were, some of them were carved. And the photographer said, "I don't want to be around you right now." And as they approached, I remember reaching into my back pocket and pulling out my notebook. That one thing, and this begins to, again, listening, changed everything. Once they saw that notebook, people wanted to tell their story.
Do you still, if you're out reporting now, do you still carry a physical notebook? There it is right there. Okay.
Now I use 3x5 cards, but I always have it.
Yeah.
Having a notebook is just something that connects people in a way that I've never really understood.
Well, in closing, Mark, there's this really beautiful note at the end of your retrospective where you talk about the unexpected ways that your stories find their way to people. Why is that important to you?
I think it gives you that little kick about that you're not doing it for yourself, that there are reasons why you're out there. And one that hit me is I was a columnist at the Seattle Times, and I had to come up with a story on a short notice. And it was one where I hadn't done my homework. I hadn't prepared, and I was like getting closer and closer to deadline. And for whatever reason, I decided to do one on the Haskell Indian Nation's girls basketball team. And so I started calling people and finally found a player and talked to her. They were in the playoffs, so it was a big deal for them. And this young woman that I interviewed said, "You know, I'm here to school. My goal is to be a lawyer." And about 15 years later, she sent me a note that said, "Every time I thought about quitting school, I pulled out that article."
Wow.
And now I'm a lawyer.
That's beautiful. Well, Mark Trahant is the former editor of ICT and the recipient of the 2025 IF Stone Medal. Mark, thank you so much.
Glad to be here.
And that's it for this Thursday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. For Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.